Okay, we're finally to the point of getting to a regular chapter, so to speak, which is about an organ system. And then that's what we'll be doing for the rest of the term. This is actually about a little bit more than an organ system. It's primarily about the integumentary system. But it's the name of the chapter is Skin and Membranes, and that's because not all membranes are members of the integumentary system. So it covers the integumentary system and just a little bit more. But the skin is a membrane, and here I'm talking about macroscopic membrane, like I was using the words before. There are membranes within a cell. Those are subcellular membranes. There are also membranes made out of many cells, so multicellular membranes, and that's what we're talking about with the skin, of course. There are millions, billions of skin cells in the body. And so the skin can also be called the cutaneous membrane. Cutaneous just means of the skin. And that, of course, is a member, the skin, of the integumentary system, right, as we've talked about. Now, integument, which of course is what integumentary is named for, is a word that means covering. So the skin is part of the integument. It's not the entire integument, though, because the integument also includes hair and nails. The integumentary system includes skin, hair, and nails for the most part. And skin, by the way, is... Actually, let me pause for a second because I wanted to make sure I remembered to tell you this. And I probably will forget if I get too deep into the skin. This is the last chapter for the unit, which means the exam's coming up, whatever date the syllabus says. And recently, Estrella made the decision that they're going to be cheap and not provide Scantrons anymore to students for free. Not like they're expensive, but you're now going to have to buy those. And you'll have to have one coming into the test. I won't have any extras. So that means buy a whole term's worth. I don't know how much they are, a dime each or something at the bookstore. Buy enough for the entire term and buy a couple extras so that the two or three of you who just ignore what I'm saying today and come without one can borrow one from you, because I won't have any. They're the standard green ones, the long green ones with, I think, 50 on one side, 50 on another side. Okay, anyway, the skin is a membrane. It's a multicellular membrane. It's also an organ, though. Probably people wouldn't guess this if you just interviewed random people on the street. They would, they think of organs as being the viscera, which are these internal organs, mostly in the abdomen, things like kidneys and livers. Those, of course, are organs. But the skin is an organ, too, which makes sense, right? Because consider the hierarchy of biological organization that we talked about, the chemical level and upward. Well, cells is one level of that, right? The cellular level. And then cells of different types combine to form more complex things called organs, doing a specific job. Well, that's true of the skin. I skipped tissues. Cells make up tissues, and then tissues of different types make up organs. Well, that's true for the skin, right? I shouldn't say right, because you might not know that yet, but the skin is more than just the cells that you can touch. That's one tissue type. What is the part of the skin that you can touch?
The dermis.
Not the dermis, the epidermis. And this is kind of confusing, by the way, because, and I'll talk more about this when we get to a better picture, but dermis means skin, but actually it's only part of the skin. Epidermis means over the skin, but the epidermis is also actually part of the skin, so it's confusing terminology. Anyway, the epidermis is an epithelium, right? That's one tissue type, as you've been learning. The dermis, which is deep to that, still part of the skin though, is connective tissue, a different tissue. And so they different tissues are combining to form an organ. Skin is certainly an organ. And it, as a matter of fact, it's the largest organ of the body. It's not only large in area, but when you, if you take all the skin off, it is the heaviest organ. Weighs more than anything else. So that is by far the most conspicuous and important part of the integumentary system. But the integumentary system includes skin and hair and nails. And the skin, as far as position, of course, is... What word would you use to describe it? Its position. Well, not all of it is superior. The soles of my feet aren't superior, and that is skin.
Superficial,
right. The skin is almost... I mean... The skin is the most superficial thing in almost all cases, right? There's only a couple things here and there that are more superficial than the skin. What are those? Hairs, pretty much, right? And nails. But the skin overall is very superficial. Almost everything in the body is deep to the skin. And that, of course, makes sense because the purpose of the skin is mostly protective. It's the barrier between you and the rest of the environment. And we'll get back into the integumentary system, but let's talk about some other kinds of membranes, which really aren't part of the integumentary system, but they're lumped in here because of their multicellular membranes. In slide 2, we have an example of what's called a mucosa, which is another word for a mucous membrane. Now, if I hadn't showed you this slide with the word on it already, and I asked you how to spell mucus, it would be kind of a trick question. Because there's a word, M-U-C-U-S, which is pronounced mucus. And there's a word, O-U-S, which is pronounced mucus. So they are homophones, words that are exactly alike in pronunciation but differing in spelling and are different words. Mucus, M-U-C-U-S, is the noun. That refers to the stuff, the sticky stuff. That's mucus, right? O-U-S is a typical adjective ending. So mucus spelled with O-U-S is an adjective mean having to do with mucus, the stuff. Okay, and that's why we call membranes that produce mucus, M-U-C-U-S, we call those membranes mucus, M-U-C-O-U-S, membranes, or mucosa. And we find mucus membranes lining internal hollow structures, including the entire alimentary canal. I've talked about the alimentary canal several times, right? It's the continuous tube running from mouth to anus. And I keep mentioning it because it's outside of the body, right? Officially, you're wrapped around that. But that entire distance, even though it takes twists and turns, that entire distance is lined with an epithelium, because epithelia have the job of lining things, as we've said, right? But that epithelium is mucus. It's mucus membrane all the way through, starting right at the mouth. So that whole lining the whole way through produces mucus, in other words. Well, this happens as soon as you start chewing, which is called mastication. Right? You chew not just to make a big chunk of food smaller pieces so that it's easier to swallow. Swallowing is called deglutition. But anyway, as you're chewing, you're not just making it smaller chunks. You are mixing it with mucus that's being produced by the epithelium lining your mouth. And that, as you form what's called the food bolus, the little ball that you swallow, is now mixed with mucus and therefore slippery. Mucus is a slippery fluid. Thick, viscous, slippery fluid. So mixing mucus with the food lubricates it. And that lubrication continues all the way through. We don't call it food after it gets into our stomach. It's then called chyme. And then it'll keeps changing as it goes through farther. Eventually it's feces, but it gets lubricated the whole time so it can slip through that tube. Notice that's different from your skin. Your skin is not a mucous membrane. It's a dry membrane. And in fact, the outer epidermis that you can actually touch is made up of dead cells. The cells that you actually touch have died by the time they reach that surface, and that helps them be tough, actually. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Mucous membranes remain moist because they're continuously producing mucus. But that's not the only place. I mean, just like the alimentary canal is external to the body, continuous with the external environment, other cavities are as well. Vagina is lined by mucous membrane, for instance. The trachea, which is the airway to the lungs, that's really outside your body too. That's lined with mucous membrane. Okay, so that's mucous membranes. Now let's talk about a different category in slide 3. These are a couple examples of what generally are called serous membranes. Now, serous, another O-U-S ending, is an adjective just like mucus is. It's the adjective of serum. Now, where in the body do you know is serum? Or what are you familiar with as serum in the body? Anything? Okay, well, think back to the whole blood. We talked about whole blood being an example of a connective tissue. And all connective tissues, we said, remember, have a cellular component, some type of cells, and then extracellular matrix outside of the cells, right? That's true for all connective tissues. For the connective tissue that's whole blood, of course, the blood cells, red and white blood cells, are the cellular component. What do we call the extracellular matrix?
Plasma,
which you can separate from the cells with a centrifuge, right? You take whole blood out of a person, spin it down, the heavy cells go to the bottom, and you have plasma on the top if you want to separate the two. Well, if you then remove the cells and you have just plasma, and you spin it even faster and longer, that will spin out the proteins that are in that plasma, and you'll have a much more watery, thin liquid, which is called blood serum. Serum, in general, means a watery fluid, very thin, not viscous, not syrupy, very thin like water. Okay? So, blood serum is just one of several sera, but that's what the basis of the word serous is. And so, there are a few places in the body where there are what we call serous membranes. Each individual serous membrane, which is technically one membrane, is folded back on itself. So it seems like there's two layers of membrane. And we give them separate names, even though it's really just a fold in the same membrane. Okay? But where we see these serous membranes, like around the heart and around each lung, is places in the body where an organ is moving quite a bit with respect to all of its surroundings, and therefore needs protection, because if it were just moving directly against the surface of all of its surroundings, it would wear the hell out of itself and out of the surrounding tissue. It would just be abrasive, right? If it's continuously moving, like the heart is, since it has to beat as long as you're alive. That's what serous membranes do. They allow for movement of structures within the body next to other structures without rubbing them to the point of damage. And what you see in the insets here in detail is what I was talking about before. It's each serous membrane is just one membrane, but it wraps back on itself so that there are two layers to it. Now, one of those layers is in direct contact with the thing that's being covered by the serous membrane. Okay, so it surrounds the structure. And the other layer, after it's folded back, is more superficial compared to that to that organ it's covering. Okay. Well, we give the names parietal layer and visceral layer to those two layers of serous membrane. Now, visceral, which I used earlier when I was talking about the viscera, the deep organs, visceral means deeper. So that makes sense for the layer that's directly in contact with the organ that's being surrounded by the membrane. And the word parietal, which is the same word, by the way, that we use to describe these two bones of the cranium, parietal bones, means like a wall. These are the side walls of the cranium. That's why they get that name. But parietal here means more superficial, forming a wall with the rest of the surroundings. Okay? They are close to each other, the parietal and visceral layers. There's not much space between them. But the small space that is between them is filled with serous fluid, watery fluid. And that fluid is produced by and secreted by the parietal and visceral layers of the serous membrane itself. Okay? So it's a thin, watery layer of liquid between the two membrane layers. And these aren't all of the serous membranes of the body, but these are excellent examples. There's one around the heart. Anyone know what that one's called? What is the word that means of the heart? Cardiac. So it's going to be the same root as that. And a prefix that means around, like in perimeter, is peri, the pericardium, right? Literally, around the heart is what it means. And around each lung is a pleura. That's singular. So there are two pleurae. You make a plural of words that end in A, usually by adding an E. Two pleurae, one for each lung. And it's obvious why the lungs need them, right? Every breath, there's a big change in volume. So that would just wear the hell out of the lung and the surrounding tissues. Okay, that's serous membranes. And we can look at four, at this analogy that I think I mentioned a long time ago when I said that serous membranes are like, I might not have told you they were serous membranes at the time, but I think I used this fist in the balloon analogy, which is a good analogy. It's easy to imagine really doing this. If you use a balloon, but not an air-filled balloon, a water-filled balloon, and you don't fill it very, very much, just kind of a little bit of water in it, it's all one membrane, right? The wall of the balloon is all one sheet of latex. But if you hold it in one hand and then plunge your fist into the side of it, then what part of that balloon layer is going to conform to your fist? Just like the visceral layer of the pericardium goes directly on the surface of the heart, right? And you have water in there, so if you imagine doing that, then you could move your fist around without moving the hand holding the other hand holding the balloon, and it wouldn't rub because it would slip on that watery layer between the two balloon layers, right? The outer layer, which is really still the same membrane, it would be the parietal layer. Okay. Slide 5, another kind of membrane lining a different kind of cavity. This is not actually an external cavity, just like the serous membranes weren't. Mucous membranes were, but here we have a cavity in a highly movable joint, like a knee, for instance, or an ankle. And there's all kinds of highly movable joints in the body. And actually, when we use the word joint, which people are familiar with, outside of anatomy, just in everyday language, what we call joints really almost always refers to the highly movable joints. But anatomically, anytime two bones come together, that's a joint, whether those move or not. Like the joints of the skull aren't supposed to move, right? You're just supposed to be kept in place. Those are immovable joints. But you have plenty of highly movable joints, like the ankle and the knees and so on. And those highly movable joints have a space between the two bones involved, the two bones that join together, which is why it's called a joint. And that forms a fluid-filled space. lined by a membrane. And that fluid-filled space is called the synovial cavity. Ove, just like in ovum, meaning egg, the synovial fluid that fills that synovial cavity has kind of the consistency of raw egg white, which is why it was named that. But it's very lubricating. It's much thicker than serous fluid. Not as thick as mucus, but similar to mucus, very slippery. And there is a synovial membrane that lines this whole thing to keep all that fluid in there. But part of that membrane is actually formed by cartilage right on the surfaces of the bones. And remember when we said, I guess it was Monday, that there are different kinds of cartilage? We looked at examples, microscopic slides of fibrocartilage and hyaline cartilage, remember? What did hyaline cartilage mean? What does that word hyaline mean?
Glassy,
exactly. Because hyaline cartilage on a microscope looks like the cells that you see, looks like little bubbles in glass. And I think I told you that the biggest example of a lot of hyaline cartilage all in one place was on either side of the sternum, between the sternum and the ribs. That's all hyaline cartilage. But you also have hyaline cartilage at the ends of these bones that come together at your highly movable joints, not only cushioning the joints, but also providing slipperiness along with that fluid. And so this works well in your youth, but it wears out eventually, and that's why you older people start to have bone on bone, and they need their joints worked on. It's another membrane, though. So it's a quick overview of some important membrane types. Now we can actually get officially into the integumentary system on slide 6. And it takes 2 slides to go through this table that we're looking at. Typically, I don't read tables to you because if you have those tables already on my website, which you do, you can read them. But it's worth going through these important functions of the overall integumentary system, not all of which are protective functions, but that's largely what the integumentary system is there for, protecting you, keeping you alive. We would quickly die without the skin for a variety of reasons. But we can talk about some of those reasons as we go through these specific functions. So the integumentary system provides protection from mechanical damage. Mechanical damage means things actually bumping into you, physical trauma to your body. That would be much more damaging to the more delicate structures that are deep to the skin, muscles and visceral organs, if it weren't for the skin. The skin is pretty tough stuff. It's pretty remarkable stuff when you come to think about it. If you were trying to invent a material, it's pliable, tough, self-healing, very, very cool stuff, really. But one of the reasons that it is tough is because it contains a lot of a protein called keratin. Animals produce keratin, a type of protein. It's a fibrous protein, so it's made of long strands, and they're pretty tough. Well, skin cells have a bunch of keratin in them that's produced, of course, when those skin cells are alive. That's deeper in the epidermis, so not the ones you actually touch. I said before, those are dead. But then as they mature, they migrate toward the surface and eventually die, and that keratin makes them tough. They become cornified, which is a word that means horny. Horny in the sense of meaning hard like a horn. Horn and corn really mean the same thing. That's why it's called that. So these dead, dry, outer epidermal cells are pretty tough, and that's a lot of the reason why the skin is pretty tough. But the skin, which is epidermis and dermis, then deep to that has a layer of fat cells. Now, what kind of tissue do fat cells make up? Adipose. In fact, the individual fat cells are called adipocytes, or adipose cells, because the tissue they make up is adipose. And we talked about some important reasons, important functions of fat, right? It stores energy, but it also cushions things. And so the skin is a protective covering. Then you have a cushioning layer just deep to the skin, but superficial to the things that that the skin is protecting. And also strewn here and there within this skin are many different kinds of sensory receptors. Sensory receptors are specialized cells that are able to tell things that things are going on. They're able to sense or detect various stimuli, like being pushed on, right? You don't have to be looking at someone pushing their finger on your skin. You can feel that. Well, you feel it in your brain. That's high-level processing. But the sensory input starts because those sensory receptors in the skin can detect that change in the environment. And so there are temperature sensors, pain sensors, and so on. Those occur all the way over the body in the skin. And that's the reason that's important for protection is because being aware of things that are pushing on us allows us to do something about it, right? Pain, most people don't like pain, and it seems inconvenient, and sometimes we want to just take a drug to get rid of it. But if we didn't have pain, we would quickly die, right? Because we wouldn't know, this is killing me. We wouldn't know any better than to get away from a dangerous situation. So that's involves the skin, because the skin is the boundary between you and everything else. There's also chemical damage that can happen, and the skin can, up to a point, of course, protect against that, against acids and bases that would be much more damaging to underlying tissues than they are to the skin itself. Of course, there's limits to all of this, right? Something you can pierce the skin. It's not perfectly mechanically protective, and you can have too strong an acid or a base, it's still going to damage your skin. But the skin is pretty resistant to just moderate changes in pH compared to the other tissues. Microbe damage, this is a real big one. This is one of the reasons why you would very soon die without the skin, because the skin is a barrier, pretty effective barrier, disallowing trillions of potentially harmful microorganisms from infecting your body, right? Now you have billions and billions of bacteria living on your skin all the time, and in fact you need those for various reasons. But among those billions are some that can actually harm you, and those the skin is hopefully keeping out of your body, keeping you from becoming infected. There's a couple reasons for this. It's just basically a physical barrier for one thing, but the skin also produces what's called the acid mantle. The acid mantle is a thin layer of acidic solution. Salty and acidic solution. It's both acidic and salty. And saltiness and acidic nature makes it harder for several kinds of bacteria to survive. So they just don't make it past the acid mantle. That'll kill them. All right. You also have specialized cells crawling around in your skin continuously, surveilling your skin for potential invaders. And if they find them, they will just eat them. They will undergo phagocytosis, right? Engulf them and then just digest them. Those are therefore called phagocytes. There's all kinds of different phagocytes. That's a general word. But a phagocyte is a cell that undergoes phagocytosis. If you didn't have these functions, the acid mantle and these phagocytes and just the physical barrier of the skin, then you would quickly get infected and die. And people used to routinely die from just simple cuts. We still can, still can happen. And in fact, it's happening more and more again. But it used to happen much more before the advent of antibiotics, which, you know, have existed your whole lifetime. But you might be surprised at how recently we've only had antibiotics. Penicillin was the first one developed on a scale that could be used medically, right? You have a feel for how long ago that was? The 40s. So even more recently. You know, that's only... You have plenty of people still alive who were born, who were before there was any antibiotics available. And in those days, just a simple cut could kill you. We're getting back to that point, unfortunately, by the way, because as we use antibiotics, this is causing natural selection to occur and increasing the resistance of bacteria to the antibiotics that we have. It makes sense that this happens, right? Because if a antibiotic is effective, it will kill the bacteria. But just by random mutation, some bacteria become immune to the antibiotic. So when we use it, we're killing only the ones that are vulnerable. And the ones that happen to not be affected by the bacteria are the ones that live and multiply. So now the next generation, that antibiotic won't work anymore. So we need to continuously change them, but we've largely given up the search for new antibiotics because of the insane policy of having a for-profit pharmaceutical industry. There's no money in it, so that as a corporation, they don't want to do that. They want to make drugs that you're going to have to take for a long time, like Viagra or whatever, because there's money in that. And so that's getting us to the point now. There's so much antibiotic resistance in bacteria that we're back to the days, close to the days when we didn't have antibiotics to begin with, and simple cuts will be killing people. Skin, though, really helps for that reason. Ultraviolet radiation, which is part of sunlight. Ultraviolet radiation is light. It's just not visible to us. Radio waves are light. Microwaves are light. What we call light, the visible portion, is light. It's all the same kind of energy. It just has different frequencies and wavelengths. And ultraviolet radiation is dangerous compared to those other types because it can damage DNA. It causes mutations. Mutations are changes to DNA, and that can cause cancer. Cancer is a genetic disorder because it results from changes to the DNA. Now, genetic disorder doesn't mean that it's heritable, right? You don't give cancer to your children, and you didn't get cancer from your parents. But it's genetic because it involves DNA, it involves the genes. And so as we live our life, we accumulate more and more damage, especially if you're foolish enough to smoke or something like that. It depends on what you're doing to your body as to how much damage is accumulating. Well, UV radiation is continuously damaging the DNA in our skin cells, which is why it causes melanoma and other cancers. Thankfully, the skin has a way of coping with that to a certain amount, and that's because the skin produces little molecules of pigment called melanin. Melanin is what gives the skin color, and so different people have different amounts of melanin, which is why everyone is some shade of brown, from very light to very dark. But this is pretty cool how this happens. Within a skin cell, which has a nucleus, right? And what is in the nucleus? The DNA, which is what is vulnerable to UV. That's what you don't want to damage, the DNA. So the melanin is a pigment. Pigments are chemicals that absorb light. And so melanin does this. It absorbs the light, so the light, the UV light, does not damage the DNA. But when the melanin is produced by the skin cell, it doesn't get evenly dispersed throughout the whole volume of the cell. It actually starts to cluster, the little melanin molecules, just on one side of just the nucleus. And specifically, the side, the superficial side, where the sunlight is coming from. So it forms a little parasol over just the nucleus, protecting it specifically. Some does make it through, of course, and that's why the more you're exposed to UV, the more likely you are to undergo damage. And we're damaging our DNA. Another thing that helps us is that as UV damages the DNA, a lot of times the cell is able to recognize that has happened and correct it. So it undoes the what would otherwise be a cancer-causing thing. But when it gets out of hand and it can't correct it, that's when you have to get cancer. Okay. Thermal damage, meaning either direction, too hot or too cold, is also protected for by the skin because, once again, there are receptors, not just for pain, but we can feel when things are getting warmer or getting cooler on our skin. And if it's too severe, we're going to go away from that too hot or too cold thing. Desiccation is another major thing beyond, along with microbe damage. This is another reason why without your skin you would die very soon. Because all of the deeper parts of the body, muscles and other organs and everything that the skin is covering, those have to be moist in order to work. Right? We've talked about the importance of water to cells. What we call life is just aqueous solution chemistry. Chemical reactions happening in a watery solution, right? So you have to have everything moist in order for life to occur. Well, without the skin, there would be continuous evaporation of a lot of water. We would just dry out, which is what desiccation means. Okay? Oh, I should mention that the reason that the skin prevents this, skin is not perfectly, but it's pretty waterproof. And the reason is because of specifically the epidermis of the skin, which is the outer part, right? What kind of tissue is it?
Epidermis?
Yeah.
Epithelial.
Epithelial, right. Epithelial. And remember that compared to connective tissues, epithelial tissues are mostly cellular. There's very little extracellular stuff. It's almost all cells packed together, right? Same with the epidermis of the skin. But it's kind of like a bricks and mortar arrangement, where the bricks are the individual epidermal cells, the skin cells. But just like a brick wall is not going to be very tough if it's just a pile of bricks, right? You have to have mortar between those bricks to seal it and to keep it together. Similarly, the skin cells, which are the bricks, have mortar-like substance between them that comes from those cells and gets secreted by those cells. And that contains glycolipid, keratin as well, which makes it strong. But glycolipid is, of course, a lipid. As you can tell from the word, glyco means sugar. So a glycolipid is a lipid molecule that a sugar, a carbohydrate, has been stuck onto. So overall, it's a glycolipid. But lipids are just like the lipid tails of the phospholipids that are trying to avoid water. Lipids in general do not want to interact with water. So you make this mortar between the cells out of glycolipids, which are water resistant, and the whole skin surface becomes pretty waterproof. The rest of the table is shown on 7. These are functions that are not protective, but really important as well. The integumentary system allows for thermoregulation. Thermoregulation is part of homeostasis, but it's specifically the maintenance of body temperature. And so thinking back to when we were first talking about homeostasis, it involves variables, right? You have any given kind of variable. Well, here the variable is body temperature. And remember that homeostasis, or the feedback mechanism, specifically negative feedback, which leads to homeostasis, involves the variable itself, which has a certain set point, right? The set point is the desired value, so what the body wants its temperature to be at. But there's also the actual value at the moment for that variable, which might not be right at set point, right? Usually isn't right at set point. It's either above or below. And therefore, that's an error, right? Any difference between the actual value of the variable and the set point is an error. You can have an error in either direction. So that would correspond to body temperature being too high or too low. We can tolerate fluctuations in body temperature above and below the set point, but not too great above and not or too low. Either one of them can kill you. So the skin comes to the rescue. If the body temperature is too hot, there's a couple different ways in which the integumentary system helps to bring body temperature back down. One is that, well, what do you start doing if you're too hot? You start to sweat. Mammals are able to sweat. Sweat glands are in the skin, by the way. I didn't mention that before. And you have, in addition to receptors, you have glands in the skin as well, including sweat glands. Well, sweat glands produce just a kind of salty but mostly watery substance called sweat that gets secreted from the glands onto the surface of the skin. And that allows for the water part of that sweat to evaporate. And evaporation takes a lot of heat away from the body. By the way, the reason that happens, if we think about just a beaker full of water, these dots are water molecules. Well, before I get to that analogy, let me just say that heat and temperature are different things. Okay? They're not the same. They're related, but they're not the same. Heat is the energy of the motion of particles. And therefore, the more particles you have, the more heat you have. Right? Because you have more motion with more particles. This makes heat an example of what we call an extensive property. Because the extent, how much you have of that stuff, matters. Okay? Temperature, on the other hand, is a measure of the average speed of the particles. When you take an average, right, you add up the total and then you divide by however many there are, right? So that's an intensive property because it doesn't matter how much stuff you have. Just to make a real world sense of that, if you imagine a swimming pool contains however much water, a pretty big chunk of water. Well, you can put a thermometer in there and get a temperature of the water, right? That would give you an indication of the average speed of those particles. They're all moving at their own speeds at any given moment, but there's an average. That's the temperature. If you take a cup full of water out of that pool and you immediately measure the temperature, it will be the same as the pool, right? So the temperature is equal. But the pool contains a hell of a lot more water than the cup of water. And therefore, it contains a hell of a lot more heat. Right? Heat and temperature are not the same thing. But now back to this beaker example to explain why evaporation does cool you. I just said that temperature is the average speed of the particles. Okay? All these water molecules in this beaker are moving at different speeds, but there's an average speed. Now, evaporation really just refers to going from the liquid state to the gas state. So from liquid water to water vapor. That's not a chemical change, right? You still have exactly the same stuff. It's just water molecules, whether it's in the liquid or the gas state. But what's the big difference between liquid and gas, as far as the particles are concerned? Exactly. Much, much more spread out. So in a liquid or a solid, the particles are very close together. Moving still, but very close together. In a gas, there's a hell of a lot of space between them. And that's really the difference. So evaporation means some of these water molecules are leaving this population of liquid and going off on their own, spaced out in the air. If you're one of these if you consider these water molecules in the liquid phase, what kind of water molecules are going to be the best candidates for being able to go off on their own? They're all chemically identical, but they're moving, right? They're all moving as well. which ones would be most likely to escape? The fastest ones, right? The ones that are moving fastest will be able to go off into the air most easily. So that's what happens. When evaporation occurs, what you're doing is really removing the fastest molecules from that liquid population. Well, if you do that, what happens now to the new average speed of the particles that are left behind? It goes down because you removed the fastest ones from the class, right? Now the average is going to be lower, which means the temperature is lower. So evaporation cools the liquid from which it is occurring. And that's the surface of our skin, so that cools us. And we don't really notice sweating unless it's kind of humid out, because the air can hold only so much water vapor. When it's kind of humid, not as much water is able to evaporate from our skin, and we actually see it accumulating as moisture on our skin. But on a dry day, and if it's still the same heat, you're still sweating that much as when you're getting soaked on other days. It's just that that's immediately evaporating, and that's what's keeping you alive, because that's shedding so much heat from your body that you're not going into some sort of distress and dying from that. So that's one way, just evaporation, that the skin helps out in thermoregulation. But also, what else do you notice about a person who's hot, skin-wise? They're red. You get flushed, right? And that's because much more blood than usual is being sent to the skin. Now, all the living cells of the body need to have a blood supply. They'll die without it, right? So the blood is able to go to all parts of the body. But it's never the case that blood is being sent to all parts of the body at once. That would be disastrous, because it would drastically lower the blood pressure in the body. It would be just like every single person in the whole valley flushing the toilet at once, using all that water at one time, right? The water pressure would drop, and nothing would be coming out of your faucet. We call that shock when it's a drastic decrease in blood pressure. So the body doesn't do that. It sends blood to certain places for a little bit, and then it'll switch off and send it to the other places, so that none of the parts of the body die, because they don't go very long without blood. But there's adjustments being made continuously. Well, when you're hot, much more blood is sent to the skin. And that's because of something I said earlier about heat. Anything made of material, anything that has particles moving, contains heat, right? That includes blood. Blood transports heat because those particles of blood are moving. So that heat gets picked up when the blood gets warmed in the core of the body, which is away from the surface. And if you then send that warm blood to the surface, the heat conductively gets lost from the skin. Cools that blood, and then it goes, takes another trip, gets warmed up, it comes back to the skin, it sheds it. So that works as well. Now, the other direction, too cold, skin helps out as well. Just the opposite with respect to blood flow, right? Now, there's no opposite of sweating, but there is an opposite of flushing, right? When you're cold, you pale, you get whiter looking because not as much blood, you're keeping blood from going to the skin, so that you will keep that heat in the body rather than dumping it to the surface. That helps out. Okay, urea and uric acid. Now, this is a pretty minor function of the system, but it's listed because it does happen. Urea is a nitrogen-containing compound that is a waste product. Now, proteins contain nitrogen because every amino acid that proteins are made out of contains nitrogen. In fact, that's what amino means, nitrogen. Normally, though, proteins are not used for fuels very much. They can be, but they usually aren't. Usually what we use for fuels, for our own energy, is sugars, carbohydrates, and fats. Okay, but if we use proteins are not usually used because they're recycled. Right, we'll break down a protein, whether it's from food we eat or whether it's one of our own proteins. We break those down into amino acids that they're made out of. And then we reassemble them into brand new proteins according to the instructions in our genes. So they're just recycled. But they can be used as fuel. And when they're used as fuel, breaking them down produces ammonia, which is nitrogen waste. And ammonia is toxic if it builds up. So the body doesn't allow it to build up. Among the many important functions of the liver is that the liver will convert that ammonia into urea, which is also toxic if it builds up too high a level, but not nearly as toxic as ammonia. So it's a better to make it into urea. Then the urea gets sent to the kidneys and it gets filtered out of the blood and becomes part of the urine. Okay. Well, that's by far, the kidneys are by far what how most of this urea gets processed. The skin helps, but it's almost negligible how much it helps. It's just that among the mixture of things that the sweat contains, there's a little bit of urea in it as well. So sweat contains the same stuff that urine does, basically, just a much smaller scale. And then synthesis of vitamin D. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing, too, because, well, why are vitamins called vitamins? Yes, they are vital, meaning necessary for life. But there's a lot of things that are necessary for life, but a lot of those things we can make them, right? Vitamins, in most cases, are vital molecules that the body cannot manufacture. And therefore, since we'll die without them, we have to get them from our food. Okay? That's true for almost all vitamins. But vitamin D is actually an exception because we can make a certain amount of vitamin D. Importantly, we get it from the food as well, but we can make vitamin D unlike other vitamins. And that involves the skin. It also involves ultraviolet radiation, so it's kind of a trade-off. If you don't get enough vitamin D from your food, the sun can help you out on that. But on the other hand, that same UV is going to damage you if you get too much. But what happens here, and you don't have to remember the names of these molecules, I'll tell you. I'm just telling you how it happens because it's kind of interesting. You have cholesterol in your skin cells. Same cholesterol that I mentioned is the precursor for all the steroid hormones, right? Estrogen and progesterone and testosterone all come from cholesterol. Well, cholesterol in the skin, when sunlight strikes the skin cells, gets chemically converted into something called cholecalciferol, which then travels via the bloodstream to the liver. The liver then converts that cholecalciferol into what's called calcidiol, and then the calcidiol, taking a trip via the blood to the kidneys, gets transformed by the kidneys into what's called calcitriol. And that's the active form of vitamin D. And then that travels, once again, by the bloodstream to the small intestines, which is where vitamin D does most of its job. Do you know what vitamin D is good for? Yeah, we often associate it as being good for the bones, and that's because, well, what? It's not good only for the bones. The whole body needs it, but the reason that we say it's good for the bones is because the bones are hard because of what element that's in them?
Calcium.
Calcium, right? Calcium is important for the bones themselves, but the rest of the body vitally needs calcium as well. Your heart wouldn't work without calcium. A lot of things wouldn't work without calcium. And calcium comes in from your food, right? You get calcium from your food. But we kind of suck at absorbing calcium. Even if it's in the food that we eat, remember, that's out of our body until it gets absorbed by the small intestine. The small intestine doesn't do a very good job of absorbing calcium. Even if it's there in the food, it'll just pass through us. So that's what vitamin D does. That's why I said the final stop is the small intestine. With the help of vitamin D, it's able to transport calcium into the body through the small intestine, and therefore we remain alive. But it starts out with skin. Okay, now on to 8, and we can start talking about the anatomy of the system itself. Here we have a little chunk of skin. Actually, it's a little bit more than skin. Notice on the side here to the left, you have epidermis, this bracketed part, and then dermis. And those two together make up skin. Even though dermis means skin and epidermis means on the skin, they're both parts of the skin. Below that, though, is hypodermis. And the hypodermis isn't really technically part of the skin. What does hypo mean as a prefix? Below. Like a hypodermic needle means a needle that goes below the skin, deeper. So hypodermis is deeper. It's the deepest of these three layers, but it is not technically part of the skin. All right? And notice that these are different kinds of tissues in each layer. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. The superficial layer, part you touch, is the epidermis. That's an epithelium, epithelial tissue. The dermis is mostly connective tissue, and it has the greatest variety of structure in it. Notice there's all kinds of things in the dermal layer. Connective tissue, glands, sensory receptors, bulbs of hair, those are all part of the dermis. And then the hypodermis is still other kinds of, well, it's also connective tissue, because remember, adipose tissue is connective tissue, but it's a different kind of connective tissue. The muscle that you see here labeled erector pili muscle, I didn't mention anything about muscles. These are tiny muscles. We're really close up on this, right? This is an individual hair, so you can have a feel for how small these are. So this is a tiny muscle compared to the big muscles, skeletal muscles that we usually think about. But this name, erector pili, well, what do you suppose erector means in this case? Be the same thing as if it were an E instead of an A. Right, to erect means to make stand up, right? And that's because of the fact that when it contracts, which is all that muscles can do, remember, it pulls on a hair bulb and therefore makes it stand straighter up. Whereas without that muscle, when that muscle is just relaxed, not pulling, the hair is lying down more. Well, what about the pili part of this word? Pili, like a lot of words that end in I, is plural, like cacti, it's plural of cactus. Pili is the plural of pilus, which means hair. And you see this in other words. For instance, if you think of the various brands of lotions that can dissolve hair, like Neat and Nair, what are those lotions called? What are they examples of? What kind of lotions or cream? They're called depilatory cream. D meaning remove, and that P-I-L from pilus meaning hair. Depilatory. By the way, just to continue on this pilus etymology, there's also a word, horripilation. Anyone have an idea what this is? Notice the pile part, meaning hair. What would you guess? What would you guess the first part of this means?
Grow.
Not grow.
Maybe.
What's this first part look like? What other word?
Horror.
Horror. Horripilation is hair standing on its end when you're scared. When you're scared or you're threatened. And you see, this doesn't really do much for us because we have such sparse hair compared to most mammals. But you'll see long-haired dogs, when this happens, it makes them look bigger. If they're threatened, they will look bigger when they horripilate, and hopefully that will make the threatening thing think twice about messing with them. It's avoidance of fighting, really, by saying, I'm not someone you want to mess with. But it happens also when we're sometimes just because of thermal reasons. Anyway, that's called horripilation. So erector pili are muscles that erect the pili, the hairs of the skin, by pulling on them. And when that happens, by the way, the layer, let me just draw it. If you have skin with, this is many cells, so if you have a bunch of hairs on the skin, all pretty much lying down, then those, there is some air trapped in this layer between the hairs, outside of the skin, but between the hairs, right? There's some air trapped in there. It's not completely trapped, but compared to the wind out here, which is easily moving, this air is kind of kept in place. And that layer of still air is kind of like an insulation. Now, when the erector pili muscles erect the hairs, now you have this situation, right? They've stood up, and they therefore are now taller, and so this layer of still air is deeper. And that causes a little bit more insulation. Keeps you a little bit warmer in that case. So we have epidermis and dermis. And one thing that comes out from this pretty strikingly, from this figure, is that of those two layers of skin, epidermis and dermis, dermis is much thicker. The dermis is much thicker than the epidermis. Even though the epidermis itself is many, many layers of cells thick. Okay, so you can see all these little spots. Those are all layers of cells, which makes the epidermis what kind of epithelium? Well, based on the fact that there's many layers, makes it what kind? Makes it stratified. It is highly stratified. Not just stratified, but there are many, many layers. And you're right that if you further classified it, it would be not only be stratified, it would be stratified squamous. Because you don't care about these underling, the shapes of these ones, right? You care about the ones in the outer surface, and those are squamous shaped.
The epidermis is like super thin compared to like...
to the dermis, right.
It's because like, they're all dead, right? And because they're all dead, they don't take up as much space because there's no fluid in them?
Well... they aren't all dead. They only the ones we touch are dead. These ones down here are alive.
Okay.
And continuously undergoing cell division to produce more and more cells. And that's why they get pushed upward as more and more cells are produced by the living ones. They get pushed upward toward the surface, and in that process they develop and then eventually die and flatten out. But that alone is not really the reason it's thinner. You could have an even thicker layer of epidermis with even more layers of cells. It's just that the dermis itself happens to be much thicker. It wouldn't have to be, but is. Right, it has to house a bunch of stuff that takes up room in the dermis. Now, not only is the dermis much thicker than the epidermis, but the two layers don't come together just in a flat line, in a plane. Notice that the edge between the dermis and the epidermis is kind of wavy. Okay? Kind of like eggshell foam. You know what I'm talking about? Packing material that has little bumps in it and it's not just a flat surface. That's kind of what the interface between the epidermis and dermis is, and therefore notice in the bracket that where we see dermis, the dermis itself is subdivided into papillary layer and reticular layer. It's all dermis, but the papillary layer is just this
outermost part, more superficial part. Oh, here's this where the epidermis has been peeled away. You really see that egg crate foam
shape. But that's just that part is the papillary layer. Why is it called the papillary layer? Well, that's the adjective of papilla, which means a finger-like projection. There's all kinds of papillae in the body, like on the tongue, for instance. It has that rough appearance because those are little finger-like projections, papillae. But each of these is a papilla, a dermal papilla, plural of which is papillae. And therefore, the layer that has those little projections of the dermis is called the papillary layer. Okay? Then when you get below those, you're into the reticular layer. It's still dermis, but the reticular layer is named for the fact that there's a bunch of protein fibers in that connective tissue component of the dermis, and those fibers are going in pretty much all directions. They're not aligned like they are in a tendon, right? It makes sense for them to be aligned in a tendon, because a tendon being pulled by a muscle, and that's the only thing it does, always gets pulled in the same direction. So they don't have to have strength in the other directions. But skin can be moved in all directions. So it needs to be strong in all directions, and therefore has fibers in the extracellular matrix of this connective tissue being oriented in all directions. And when you think about a bunch of fibers going in all directions, the overall arrangement would look kind of like a web, right? Or a net. Well, that's what reti means. Reti is a web-like network. And a small reti is a reticulum, because iculum just means a small version of whatever word it's connected to. And reticular is the adjective of that. So that's the difference in the two dermal layers. You get a good view here of sweat glands when I was mentioning before that the sweat gets delivered right on to the exterior surface of the epidermis. It starts out in the dermis. That's where the gland, the bulk of the gland is. So that's where the sweat is produced, in those cells of that gland. And then it gets released and squeezed through the coiled tube or the duct of that gland until it gets delivered to the surface of the skin, and that's where it evaporates from. By the way, the flushing that we were talking about of the blood when we're hot, or the keeping blood away from the skin when we're cold, that involves these blood vessels, of course. Notice that they are fairly deep. They're at the bottom, or the deep part of the dermis, for the most part. Now, there are smaller vessels that are capillaries that are carrying blood, more superficial. But these larger ones are deep. Notice, though, that they are not deeper than the hypodermis. Why would it not make sense to have them deeper than the hypodermis? Well, the hypodermis is made up of mostly what tissue? Adipose, which is filled with fat. Think about what I said are the functions of fat. We said cushioning, but what else? To an extent, yeah, well, mostly protection because of cushioning. But what else did I say fat does? Stores energy. And that's not what we're talking about here, though, either. Thermal insulation, right? You wouldn't want to put the tubes of blood below that, because then the heat would stay on this side of the insulation. You wouldn't be able to dump it to the skin, right? Does that make sense? Okay. That's probably a good place to stop. Just take a little bit longer break before quiz.